On this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio, gun rights advocates are up in arms over Governor Abbott's new gun proposals. We'll talk to our friend Joanne Fleming about that. I'll also sit down with Carrie Cheshire and Brandon Waltons to preview the state Republican convention and issues taxpayers need to be on the watch out for there. And in this week's commentary, Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us about how the crusade against unfunded mandates has been hijacked by the grow government crowd. Welcome back to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I'm your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios. You know, as we were talking about on the program last week, the governor is out with some new gun proposals, and there's a serious outcry from gun rights advocates about some of the real nasty negative effects of some of these proposals. And so for that, I wanted to talk to Joanne Fleming with Grassroots America, We the People. Joanne, thanks for coming on. Thank you for leading the charge to defend our Second Amendment rights.
Well, thank you. You know, when it comes to our God-given liberties, you have to fight what is beginning to smell like fire with a firestorm. So, you know, my advice to all Republican elected officials out there, if you don't want none, don't start none.
Well, I mean, it's very concerning. You have the governor proposing certain gun control measures in the wake of the Santa Fe shooting. And some of these proposals, the Democrats are saying, hey, the Republicans are coming around and endorsing our point of view. And there's a lot of room for worry there. Tell us about what you're seeing in the proposals and what raises concerns to you substantively, policy-wise, with what's been laid out there.
Well, the additional burdens on law-abiding citizens to secure guns, and the erosion, the potential for erosion of parental rights. You know, Tony, you know, it always appears that our leaders in Austin somehow take a more cosmopolitan, metropolitan approach to policy issues and seem to want to smack those down on top of everybody in Texas. Well, you know, in case they haven't noticed, there's a different culture than in the metro areas. In rural Texas, in places where there's an abundance of places to hunt, and there's, you know, there are more remote areas of the state, parents and grandparents, you know, raise children to be independent, to learn how to protect life, liberty, and property. And, you know, I come from a time, and it actually still happens since the dinosaur age, that, you know, people get, you know, give responsible children a 22, say at the age of 8 or 9.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I owned my first gun when I was 9 years old. It was a little 22 long rifle that hung on the wall of my bedroom there. And under some of these proposals, which seem to treat teenagers and firearms as incompatible. Under these proposals, you could be at risk of a felony just for allowing me to have my little 22 long rifle there on the wall of my bedroom as a child.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it seems that in overall in the proposals, the things that would apply, the proposals that would apply to schools, is they take a very soft approach to that. And, you know, then all the burden seems to be on the law-abiding citizen. So that's the overall take that we have. The red flag petitions are of a great concern to us, because what conservative hasn't in at some point when you've testified against, property tax hikes, school bond elections, some nutty thing that an elected body will try to do to erode private property rights, et cetera. In whose time of interacting with government have you never had the idea that they would just as soon have you arrested and put you in jail than to listen to you.
Well, we've seen a spate of political prosecution in this state against conservatives, and I absolutely agree with you. You know, if they had the opportunity, and I try and do everything as above board as possible just because I don't want to let them have an excuse. But, you know, let's talk about those two proposals. The first one is this requirement. It's not a storage law in the traditional sense. It's not the proposal isn't to say, well, you have to keep a gun lock on your guns, or you have to lock them in a safe, or you have to do this. But effectively, it's basically saying that has to be the policy. Otherwise, somebody comes into possession of the guns, you could be prosecuted for a felony.
Well, absolutely. If someone steals your gun, then that's going to get, and they use it to commit a crime, then here comes your local district attorney, who many of them employ selective prosecution anyway. So if you have a local district attorney that, you know, you've been a problem in the past because you've spoken out on this, that, or the other, then here you've got a district attorney that's decided, okay, you're already an outspoken citizen, and so we just need to define, we need to determine whether or not we think you had your gun secured. It leaves it much too much up to the interpretation of a local district attorney. I mean, and to me, it adds one more burden on law enforcement to make those types of assessments, to go all the way back and say, well, how is this gun secured?
Yeah.
You know, and it has the smell of being a burglar protection act, or putting the focus back on who owned the gun as opposed to what was done with the gun to commit a crime.
Yeah, right now there's some laws on the books, and I think they're problematic enough, passed by the Democratic legislature back in the 90s, that say, you know, if you have a loaded firearm and it is in the, you know, area of a child, and the child then takes and possesses it and then causes some problem, that would be a crime. And it's very odd, you know, it's a very few, I can't think of other examples where you commit a crime not by taking an action, but by taking an action and then somebody else taking an action. You know, it's very odd. But that's the existing law that's problematic. They want to increase the penalties on that, but more problematically, they want to say, oh, we want to get rid of this loaded firearm provision. So even if you're on a trip, you're going to the hunting camp and you're staying there and you've got a unloaded firearm with you, by definition, really to comply with this law, you would have to put a trigger lock, or you'd have to lock it away in a lock box or something like that, which is just not common and not normal.
No, it takes away access to that firearm. If you're in a situation where you believe that your life is threatened, to add more layers to keep you from being able to effectively use that weapon to protect yourself or the life of others is just not, it's not something that we're looking for here. And this actually, Tony, I believe that this proposal as it is has been laid out for us would gut the Castle Doctrine.
Yeah. Well, explain how that would be the case.
Well, you know, anything that puts more burdens on a gun owner, a responsible gun owner who lawfully has the possession of that weapon, to do anything with additional, you know, whether the gun has to be locked down, whether it's loaded or unloaded, to put those additional burdens supplants the individual's sense of safety and how they can readily protect their own home and the lives in their home from a predator, to me undermines some of the pro self-protection laws, such as the Castle Law that we already have on the books.
Right.
I mean, you're just adding more burden is put on the lawful gun owner.
Yeah, on the one hand, we have state policy adopted from the right perspective, saying, "Well, we want to protect people in their rights to defend themselves, defend their life, liberty, and property." And on the other hand, we're saying, "Well, we want to put up a bunch of barriers to make it impossible for you to effectively do that through these micromanagement of storage of firearms and that sort of thing." You know, one of the points that you've been making is about the funding for the proposals from the governor aren't just about these gun control provisions, which are problematic. It's ostensibly about school safety. But even in that, we're out there saying, well, we want more federal dollars. Gimme, gimme, gimme. And there's some problems with that.
Well, it is. We have said for the longest time that Texas, our officials in Texas need to have a serious conversation about how and why we spend money and how and why we actually depend on the federal government for way too much. It averages between 55% and 37% of our state budget revenue comes from federal dollars anyway. That's usually translates to a tune of about $69 to $75 billion. Well, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of federal strings that can come attached to the come with those funds. So I just find it extremely problematic that our officials are looking to Washington, D.C. to help fund some solutions that we ought to be developing ourselves in Texas.
Yeah.
I don't think that we don't need Washington, D.C. money coming in and muddying the water and policies for Texas.
Yeah,
Texans deserve better.
It could be a penny wise and a pound foolish. Well, I think that's all the time I have today with you. Tell folks and listeners out there how they can learn more about Grassroots America, We the People, and your efforts on this front.
On Facebook and Twitter at GAWTP, and the website is GAWTP.com.
Thanks, Joanne. Thank you for joining us, and keep up the good fight out there. You're doing important work.
Will do. Thank you.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Next, I wanted to pull in Brandon Waltons and Kerry Cheshire to talk a little bit about the upcoming Republican Party of Texas State Convention. I guess I'll ask you, Kerry, first, why should a listener out there who isn't a delegate to the convention care about what goes on there at the convention?
Well, Tony, I think Republicans all across the state of Texas should absolutely care about what's going on at the Texas GOP convention, because it's where a lot of decisions are made. I mean, the platform of the party that says what we believe as Texas Republicans, the legislative priorities that they're asking the Texas legislature to focus on. All of these issues are going to be decided by delegates, and also just the rules of how the party operates. You know, who's going to be in charge of it as they're deciding, you know, where to spend money in November? Who's going to be in charge of it as they're deciding what to advocate for during the Texas legislative session? Very important time for Texas Republicans.
Yeah, so one of the largest political gatherings in the world, I've been told, second only to the gathering of the Communist Party in China, 10,000 Republicans getting together in San Antonio to debate these issues. And yeah, what we've seen in previous years is things that go on at the convention might not have an immediate impact on the state, but you start to see them percolate up in your city council or in the legislature or somewhere else a few years later. Brandon, I kind of wanted to touch on with you, one of the things that we're going to see is kind of a direction of the party question. You're seeing incumbent party chairman James Dickey facing a challenge. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So one of the biggest ways, you know, ahead of this convention that people are kind of looking towards is this chairman's race. Who is going to lead the Republican Party of Texas for the next 2 years? And basically, you've got the incumbent chair, James Dickey, who came in last year. And since he's been in there, he's really gained a lot of praise and a lot of respect from conservative organizations, conservative grassroots grassroots for basically taking a return to the party platform, legislative priorities, and actually, you know, allowing the process to play out and allowing Republican lawmakers to be held accountable to those.
He was narrowly elected by the state Republican Executive Committee, which is kind of the governing body of the party. And so this is his first test to the delegates, to the, you know, kind of to the voters. The question is, has he grown his support from that time? He kind of one vote victory in the SREC. And so has he grown that support? Facing a challenge kind of from the left, obviously a Republican challenging him, but challenging and kind of criticizing some of the more grassrootsy conservative things.
Yeah, from the left, maybe. Done. Definitely from the party's establishment. I mean, you have people like Tom Meckler. This was the former Republican Party of Texas chairman before James Dickey. Endorsing and heavily campaigning for Cindy Ash. You've got...
And she, of course, is actually the daughter of former Republican National Committeeman Bill Crocker. So coming from that partisan establishment.
She's also got the support of RNC committeewoman Tony Ann DeShiel, also a big advocate for her. But at the same time, you've got Dickey, who's really laid out in the last couple of weeks, especially ahead of the convention. He's got a lot of support from actual delegates and from a lot of the SREC. And a lot of conservative lawmakers as well, rolling out endorsements from just about half the Freedom Caucus, last I looked, and a lot of conservative senators and lawmakers.
Yeah, and so we'll see a little bit about the direction of the party. Carrie, you were mentioning earlier one of the things that gets handled at the convention is the party platform, and specifically this new thing, the legislative priorities. And tell me a little bit about what are you seeing there?
Well, Tony, you know, I think the first question is, what is the party platform? And the party platform is a document that says, this is what we believe as Texas Republicans. You know, do we believe in free trade? Do we believe in protectionism? Do we believe in constitutional carry? Do we believe in additional gun restrictions? Do we believe in a consumption tax or more property taxes? All of those are questions that the platform has answers on. The platform says, this is what we believe on issues from A to Z, literally just about everything that you can think of. There's almost 500 planks on the platform, you know, addressing almost each and every issue. Something that was really cool that happened at the last convention is that for the first time, they introduced plank-by-plank voting to where delegates could vote on a Scantron just like, you know, Texas school children or people doing their work environments on, you know, I support plank 101, I support plank 102, people the ammunition to say 98.45% of delegates supported this at the convention.
Yeah, what we've seen in the past, it was, you know, here's the platform. It's more or less a take it or leave it approach for the delegates. Obviously, there would be various amendment fights. But it's unique with this vote where the delegates came in and voted on it. And it's pretty much, I mean, there's some that are kind of in the two-thirds support range. Most everything there is supported. Just about 90% of the delegates saying, we're absolutely rock solid for this plank. Interesting that the attack, so instead of saying, okay, let's prune this thing back plank by plank, there's been kind of this broadside attack to say, well, the thing's too long, right? It's too expansive. Maybe we need to shorten the thing up, and that would be one way of pruning off tons and tons of platform planks that might otherwise be supported. Do you think that's going to be back up this session during this convention?
Yeah, it's not a new movement. I mean, this has been the last several sessions. There's always been somewhat of a constituency that says, oh, well, let's start over. Let's kind of figure out eight or nine, you know, things that we want to rally around and strip it and strip down the platform.
Yeah, make the platform something really short, kind of a marketing document.
And in a recent forum, James Dickey, Chairman Dickey, was asked this, and I think he gave a good answer, which really sums it up, which is that there are thousands of bills in the legislature, and the Republican Party of Texas should be able to speak to a good amount of them, and we should be able to know where the Republican Party stands on these issues.
Well, and let's be honest here, Brandon, the real impetus and drive behind the Shorten the Platform campaign is really just an attempt to water down the platform. It's people who are uncomfortable with a lot of the actual conservative planks in the platform that they've been very upset about. You look at who is pushing the water down the platform or the Shorten the Platform mission, and it is the same people who were supporting the Texas Solution in 2016.
That was a guest worker program.
Guest worker program, a number of words for amnesty. And it's just the same little group that you know really wants to views the Republican Party as less of a vehicle for conservative reform and more of a red elephant fan club. In which they're just supposed to show up in Texas button downs and cowboy hats and talk about how much they love
how much they like Texas. Yeah. And elephants. Yeah. The reality of shortening the platform is you have your principles at the very beginning, and you get the legislative priorities kind of there. And we'll get to that in a second. Yep. If you shorten it, you kind of just end up cutting away all the meat of the planks, right? You're going to leave these principle statements, but those principle statements are just broad statements of principle. They're not specific statements about policy. And so you would lose a lot of that specificity if you shorten the document. Talking really about real specificity, those legislative priorities. This is a new thing. It's only been in there for the last couple of platforms. And now there's a whole new committee dealing with that. It's being taken very seriously. Tell us what we're maybe going to see there, Kerry.
Well, that's right, Tony. You know, the legislative priorities are a very small subset of very explicit and intentional reforms that Republican delegates are asking the legislature, asking Congress, we want you to take care of these things. They showed up for the first time. Last convention was very big success. I think a lot of people were very energized and empowered by the fact that the Republican Party was like, okay, well, we're for these 500 things, but we want you to focus on these five things. And they were things like, you know, promoting school choice, border security, ending in-state tuition for illegal immigrants.
Constitutional carry, number one.
Abolishing abortion, number two. And I think we're going to see a couple fights there this session, this kind of convention. We're going to see, number one, do we control the priorities at a number of five, or is that expanded maybe to something like 10, maybe something like 8? I think there's going to be a robust discussion about that in this next coming week. And then also, what issues rise to the relevance of being a legislative priority?
Yeah, does constitutional carry remain part of that?
Does constitutional carry stay there? Does abolish abortion, a very robust and rigorous
question? You have a significant constituency in the Republican Party that says, we want to be an incremental reform people. You know, we know that the Supreme Court will strike down a ban on abortion. We know what that's going to really result in, and so you're going to get in some kind of loggerheads with the courts. We want to try and pass stuff that actually saves lives now and doesn't end up in the courts forever. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of a differing point of view towards a similar goal.
Sure. And a lot of these legislative priorities, too, and this will probably be a big discussion as well during the convention, is how approachable do we want to make these priorities? You know, you've got some priorities, like you said, like abolition of abortion, also
abolishing property taxes.
The other one. Would delegates want to change that to, you know, something more
immediate and tangible?
Yes.
Are we able to say we're going to abolish property taxes in the next 2 years? Okay, maybe we could get on a path to do that, but that hasn't really been the debate in the legislature. Or do we want to say, hey, cap property tax increases at 4%? That's the thing the governor's supporting. That's the thing that was on the ballot. That's kind of big supported stuff. Before we run out of time, I wanted to talk about one of the issues, maybe doesn't get as much billing, but certainly some, is this Rule 44, part of the Republican Party of Texas rules about censoring public officials, Republican officials who Republican Party groups say this official hasn't actually advanced our platform. They've opposed our principles, yet they carry the Republican label. What do we think is going to happen with that rule at the convention?
Well, Tony, by looking at the resolutions passed by county conventions, Senate district conventions, you know, there's a very clear schism between the party on people who support Rule 44 and a number of those establishment forces who want to abolish it. You know, Rule 44 has been something that conservatives have wanted in a tool in their arsenal to hold lawmakers mm-hmm. accountable who fail to uphold the core principles of the Republican Party for a number of years, finally got in.
Yeah,
the last
the proposal always really was to say, hey, let's just kick them off the ballot. You know, if somebody's not a Republican, let's not let them run as a Republican. Let's just kick them off the ballot. And they kind of ended up with this compromise where you say, well, we're going to pull resources. We're not going to not let you run, but we're going to formally reprimand and pull party resources away from these elected officials. And we've seen a number of these resolutions percolate up from Senate district conventions or through the SREC. So those things actually might get a vote at this convention from the delegate. I think there's one open question is, will there be this fight over these existing Rule 44 resolutions, whether to adopt them? I mean, will the delegates get a chance to vote on those things? But then kind of looking forward, do we expand the rule to go to what everybody's kind of always proposed, a kicking them off the ballot rule, or do we reduce the rule, eliminate the rule at all, you know, entirely? What could we see there?
Well, I think it's everything that you said, Tony, but it's also, you know, I think conservatives are going to go and try and tweak the rule. I think that they've realized that the requirement that for a censure to go all the way through, and it requires 2/3 of the total number of the SREC versus just those present and voting, sets up a really interesting dynamic where you have people ducking the vote and avoiding the vote and everything else. And I think people are going to be very, very frustrated with that, and they're going to try and change that. But beyond that, as you were alluding to, there is a movement that says, we don't want these censures to exist. We don't want the grassroots to be able to hold people accountable.
It's making the Republican Party look bad.
And one of those is, a lot of those people are supporting the Cindy Ash campaign. I don't think they're going to be successful in that.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll know a lot more next week about these things. And based off the direction we see at the convention, I think we're going to know a little bit more about what we're going to see next legislative session and down the road. You know, in state and local politics, it seems like everyone is opposed to unfunded mandates, but just about no one can explain what that term actually means. Michael Quinn Sullivan tells us more in this week's commentary.
We hear a lot about unfunded mandates driving up the cost of local government, but arguing over how policy mandates get funded clouds the question of what policies should be funded in the first place. With a Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan. It's become an easy canard for local governments to blame so-called unfunded mandates for escalating costs and higher taxes. The idea lawmakers in Austin are dealing out cost-hiking mandates on local governments has the flavor of truthiness. It just sounds like something those people there would do to the good, innocent people here. Sort of. First, there isn't much agreement on what makes an unfunded mandate. Is it anything that forces local governments to do something without an accompanying stack of cash? By that measure, every criminal law on the books is an unfunded mandate. After all, the legislature determines something is now illegal, and local police departments are then obligated to enforce those laws and make arrests, while the counties must house suspects, bear the burden of prosecution. Well, should we make the criminal code optional? Well, obviously not. But that just makes the point. The definition of an unfunded mandate is about as elusive as it gets in political jargon. In observing state government for more than 20 years, it's been my experience that so-called unfunded mandates decried by local governments are often promoted by local officials themselves. And very often, when pressed, the mandates local officials chafe at are just the basic laws government imposes on everyone. For example, the Texas Association of School Boards lists school bus emissions testing as an unfunded mandate. Well, it's unfunded on everyone. Every single vehicle in Texas must undergo emissions testing. It's that whole, you know, breathe clean air stuff that I thought we were all supposed to care about and support. Does the Texas Association of School Boards really think school buses should be exempt from emissions testing? Well, fine. Go make that public argument. Let's stick with the schools. The School Board Association also criticizes requirements that school board meetings be recorded. Are they really complaining about the cost of a $35 web camera attached to a laptop? Or do they really just want to conduct their business behind closed doors with no review? They also consider it an unfunded mandate to have tax rate notices and hearings. They consider it a major burden to have a bond election or conflict of interest disclosures. And get this, school boards don't want to pay teachers, nurses, counselors, and librarians more money. I mean, that's what they say in their listing of unfunded mandates. Does that mean they wouldn't pay those people more? According to their document outlining unfunded mandates, the School Board Association also seems to suggest they wouldn't provide services to students with dyslexia. I would love for the School Board Association to make the logical argument they shouldn't have to pay for those things. Let's be clear. Local governments in Texas are not independent fiefdoms, no matter how much superintendents, mayors, or county judges may wish otherwise. They're not sovereign. They are creations. These entities exist to serve specific functions defined in the state constitution and statute. They're not masters with unlimited power. Cities, schools, counties, even the legislature are servants of the sovereign citizens of Texas. For the servants to argue over which pocket of the citizens from which to draw funds for what project is unseemly, and tends to be only a distraction from more important questions. The reality is that all mandates are funded. They are funded by the taxpayer. Whether the legislature takes money from your right pocket or the local government entity takes it from your left pocket, the money's still coming from you. The better question should always be centered around whether the policy makes sense or not. No amount of funding should be allocated to a bad policy ever. If a policy adopted by the legislature is a bad one, it should be opposed or repealed. With a Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan.
Well, that's all the time I have for you this week. Thanks for listening, and join us back here next week for another episode of Texas Scorecard Radio.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.